Good morning. Welcome to the Reagan Library. I'm Gene Meyer, the president of the Federalist Society, and welcome to our third annual Western Conference. For any of you interested in a tour at any stage, if you don't have one of these little things on your lapel, we have them for all the conference registrants at the desk there, and they get you into the library. So without further ado, we're honored to have moderating our opening panel, the Honorable Dermot O'Scanlan, who's a judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, and I'll turn it over to Judge O'Scanlan.
Thank you very much, Gene, and welcome to this morning's roundtable discussion on the compatibility of Indian sovereignty with American democracy. I am indeed Dermot O'Scanlan, U.S. Circuit Judge on the Ninth Circuit, and I will be acting as your moderator for this morning's panel. And we're lucky to have with us five distinguished specialists in Indian law who provide us with a rich spectrum of perspectives and experiences. And they are, on my far right, your left, Professor Carol Goldberg from the Law School at UCLA, Dan Kolke, next, a partner at Gibson, Dunn and Crutcher in San Francisco, Joe Mittal, legislative counsel for the Senate Judiciary Committee, Tom Sansonetti, partner at Holland and Hart in Cheyenne, and Professor Alexander Talchi-Skavine from the University of Utah College of Law. Now, before getting the panel started, I thought I would provide a little bit of context. The title of this morning's roundtable is, How Comfortably Does Tribal Sovereignty Fit with American Democratic Ideals? Now, that question is hardly new. It has been asked since the dawn of the Republic, when we dealt with the Indian tribes primarily by warfare or by treaty. And although the warfare has since disappeared and the treaties languish, we must ask again the question of today's roundtable with a sense of renewed urgency, for the terrain of Indian law remains unsettled and in constant flux, even after more than 200 years. Today's tribes enjoy something between complete sovereignty and complete federal stewardship. The Bill of Rights largely does not apply to tribal governments, nor do federal anti-discrimination or sunshine laws bind Indian tribes, and they enjoy robust sovereign immunity from suit. Nevertheless, tribes must obey federal law when Congress chooses to apply it to them. The tribes' experience in such a legal netherworld generates disputes with local and state governments, the federal government, tribe members, and other American citizens. But most of us are only dimly aware of such conflicts. Many Americans know of tribal sovereignty only because they might have visited casinos on Indian reservations. The tribe's influence on American life extends, of course, much farther than the casino grounds. In my own court, we resolve a variety of flashpoints between tribes and the rest of the country. We have explained the complex circumstances, for example, in which Indians may transfer tribal land to non-Indians. We have also addressed the extent to which tribes may regulate the use of privately owned land within tribal boundaries. We have considered claims of Aboriginal title, including exclusive hunting and fishing rights to land in Alaska. As the panelists will show, these questions represent only the tip of the iceberg of the complications that our tripartite system of sovereignty produces. The 21st century promises even more dramatic transformations in Indian law. Over the past three decades, the federal government has recognized dozens of new Indian tribes. Now, an astonishing 562 quasi-sovereign tribes, representing approximately 1.7 million Native Americans, populate the United States, each with its own distinct laws, regulations, and values. If the Akaka Bill, which would transform almost a half a million Native Hawaiians into the nation's largest recognized Indian tribe, should become law, the conflicts and complications would proliferate exponentially. The questions for today's panelists is whether our Indian law, past and future, can be squared with the traditional pillars of American constitutionalism: individual rights, limited government, separation of powers, and democratic suffrage. Is it right for some Americans to live outside the law that binds all the others? With that background in mind, I turn to today's panelists. Professor Goldberg is a nationally recognized expert in Indian law and a sometime tribal court judge, and she will defend today's Indian institutions and tribal arrangements as entirely compatible with American democratic ideals. Joe Mattal, counsel to Senator John Kyle of Arizona and counsel to the Senate Judiciary Committee, will discuss the relationship of tribes to tribal members. In particular, he will talk about how tribal sovereign immunity affects business transactions across tribal borders. Dan Kolke will focus on the relationship between tribes and neighboring state and local governments in the context of tribal-state gaming compacts. Mr. Kolke, who served as Governor Schwarzenegger's chief negotiator with Indian tribes here in California, brings a wealth of practical experience to this roundtable topic. Tom Sansonetti will discuss the intersection of tribal sovereignty and the federal government using examples from energy and environmental law. Mr. Sansonetti has served as solicitor of the United States Department of the Interior and subsequently as Assistant Attorney General for Environment and Natural Resources in the United States Department of Justice. Before we begin, Professor Alex Scavine, also an expert in Indian law, with experience on the staff of the House Committee on Interior and Insular Affairs, will place our conversation in historical context. The panelists will then speak in the order in which I've introduced them, and for 5, but no more than 8 minutes each, at least in this early round. Professor Scavine will have the opportunity to speak again at the end. I will ask questions along the way to stimulate open debate within the panel, and I will later open the floor to questions for any member of the panel from those of you in attendance. Without further ado, I turn the floor over to Professor Scavine. Alex?
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I want to thank the Federal Society for inviting me here to be part of this panel in this totally beautiful surrounding. I think it was great to. I've never been to the Ronald Reagan's Library. It's great to be here. I thought I would introduce the debate by giving what I thought would be a 5-minute kind of laying of the land in a completely unbiased, fair, and balanced way. So I will try to do this. First, concerning lay of the land as far as population. Last time I checked the census, there was about 2.5 million members of federally recognized tribes. And of those, about half live on Indian reservations. Okay, so, but in effect, there is 4 million people that claim to be Indians, which is a self-designation in the census. So you can see that there's a lot of variety of Indians. They're the ones that are federally recognized, the ones that live on the reservation, and the ones that claim to be Indians but are not recognized by the federal government. Number two, you know, we hear about 562 Indian tribes, but keep in mind that of those, 230 are Native Alaskan villages that in effect do not have Indian reservations any longer. And in addition, 170 according to Carol Goldberg, just told me, are actually in California, right here. So that, you know, if you do the math, 400 of the 562 are in those two states. So it's a little warped numbers, in effect, compared to the rest of the other 48 states. Finally, as far as Indian country is concerned, there are about 60 million acres that can be described as Indian country, which is a term of art for jurisdictional purposes. And there's another 40 million acres that are owned by Native Alaskan villages and Indian tribes in Alaska, but it's no longer Indian country. They just have ownership of the land. Okay, the next point I want to make concerns the diversity among tribes. The Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma claims 350,000 people. There was recently, I think, an article that I saw about this tribe in California with only one person. You can see, you know, big difference. The Navajo Nation, but the Cherokees don't have, in effect, a reservation. They have parcels of land here and there. The Navajo Nation has 250,000 members, but at least 150,000 basically live on a reservation, which is slightly bigger than the state of West Virginia. While some tribes, the so-called landless tribes, have no reservation at all. Finally, as a result of gaming or natural resources, some tribes are very wealthy. I think the Mashantucket Pequot has probably the highest per capita of any group in the United States, while some counties, you know, on the Rosebud Sioux Reservation are actually the poorest country in the nation. Also, some tribes, Pueblo tribes, are culturally traditional. Some of them are very, very modern, where, in effect, they no longer speak their tribal language or follow a traditional religion. Finally, racially, I think you'll see that there are some tribes that are, quote-unquote, substantially Indian and have a high blood quantum quota. Other tribes have everybody in their tribe look less Indian than I do. And, you know, I'm a quarter-blood Indian, but... The accent, I was born in France, that explains the traditional Indian accent. All right, so that's for the diversity and the lay of the land. Let me talk briefly about the history. We usually divide the history in five periods that reflect five policy of the federal government. From 1778 to 1871, the federal government dealt mostly with Indian tribes through treaties. And it contemplated the treaties, in effect, to be the governing documents that really remove the Indian tribes from being considered part of the American polity. So they were really external to the American political system. The tribes in those treaties described themselves as being dependent on the United States, but that doesn't say much. They were definitely not part of the United States politically. In 1831, Justice Marshall came down and said that they were a domestic dependent nation, and we have been trying to figure out exactly what this meant for the next 200 years. It's kind of interesting, at that time there was only six justices on the Supreme Court, and for that view, Marshall had only one other person. Justice thought that the Indian nations were completely foreign nations, and then two others thought that, in effect, they had given up all of their sovereignty. So that you can see that those three views, in effect, were very diametrically opposed. All right, 1871, Congress passed an act that ended treaty making. And shortly thereafter, the Congress started acting unilaterally by starting what we call an allotment policy, which basically allotted the reservation in 80 to 160-acre tracts, gave them to individual Indians, and then all the surplus land was put up for sale. And that period resulted in many reservations having a huge influx of non-Indians from, you know, the 1880s till 1930s. That period kind of ended in 1924 when, in effect, all Indians became officially citizens of the United States. Before, some of them had become citizens, but most of them were not. Finally, number three, the so-called Indian New Deal in 1934, the United States enacted the Indian Reorganization Act that put an end to the allotment policy, allowed tribes to adopt written constitutions that would be, in effect, ratified by the Secretary of the Interior. Four, there was a brief, what we call termination policy, which one scholar described as the allotment era on steroid, basically because it was the allotment era was to try to assimilate Indians into the mainstream. This one just terminated the status of Indians. It lasts for a short time, but it had a lasting effect because Congress, during that policy, enacted Public Law 280 that is applicable here in California. And that in Public Law 280 was, in effect, an act that allowed a certain amount of a transfer of jurisdiction to the states in the criminal era area, and also allowed opened the doors to the court, to the state courthouse, to dispute arising in Indian country. Finally, the last period, 1960, the United States adopted a policy of self-determination, and I think Nixon is the first one that came up with that policy in the late 60s, and I think we're still in there. All right. I'm going to summarize. Now, there's three overriding themes in federal Indian law that we're grappling with. One is the extent and meaning of inherent tribal sovereignty in Indian country. Number two is the power of Congress and the meaning of the trust relationship between the Congress and the tribes. And number three is the extent of state jurisdiction in Indian country. So briefly stated, the issue of inherent sovereignty is important to Indian tribes because they do not want to be considered to be, some have said, creatures of the federal government. Otherwise they become just a federal instrumentality. So, in effect, this is why they hang on to that concept that they have their own inherent sovereignty and their rights are not all derived or delegated from the federal government. Inherent sovereignty is a limited concept. In effect, there is no tribal sovereignty to allow tribal prosecution of non-Indians. And, in effect, tribal jurisdiction does not extend to civil jurisdiction over non-members unless it is absolutely necessary to trouble self-government, in that the activities of these non-members poses a real threat to tribal survival. So the second one is this plenary power and the trust relationship. The United States started dealing with tribes through treaties, but by 1903, starting in 1883, the court in effect said that Congress had plenary authority not only over Indian affairs vis-a-vis the states, but in effect had plenary authority over the affair of the Indians. And it seems that, for instance, the court today is convinced that Congress has plenary power over Indian tribes based on the Commerce Clause. As some have stated, although there are some external limitations on the power of Congress, there are no internal limitations in the Commerce Clause. So, in effect, that means that for some of you, the Lopez-Morrison line of cases that protect state sovereignty is not applicable to Indian tribes. all right. So that's the. This is some issue of concerning the plenary power of Congress and how far does it extend. Some tribal activists, have thought that, plenary power of Congress is an awful thing, and then some others think that, maybe it's not that bad because otherwise maybe it's the only thing that prevents state jurisdiction in Indian country. So with this in mind, let me move to the last thing, which is state power inside Indian reservation. In Worcester versus Georgia in 1832, Justice Marshall basically stated that because of the Commerce Clause that gave exclusive jurisdiction to the Congress, and because of the treaties with the Cherokee that were still valid, states had no jurisdiction inside Indian country. However, state jurisdiction can be granted pursuant to congressional authority. Public Law 280 here is the most notable example. Finally, the states may have jurisdiction unless such jurisdiction is preempted by federal law. and does not interfere with, quote unquote, the right of reservation Indians to make their own laws and be governed by them. This Indian preemption inquiry comes down to a balancing of federal and state interests on one hand and state interest on the other. The general principle that emanates is that states have, in most cases, at least concurrent jurisdiction over non-members on Indian reservation. And in the Supreme Court has basically said that in exceptional circumstances, the court has stated that state can regulate tribal members on their own reservation. I hope I did not go further than my 7 or 8 minutes. But thank you.
You managed to speak for 8 minutes within 12 minutes, which was very impressive. Thank you, Alex, very much. We now will hear from Professor Goldberg from UCLA, and if she will just press the little button on the very bottom.
I think it's working. Yes?
Good.
Good. Well, I too want to thank the Federalist Society for inviting me here today to this beautiful setting, and I also want to acknowledge the Chumash people on whose ancestral territory this beautiful library sits. Interestingly, the only Chumash reservation is in Santa Ynez, which is, I believe, not far from the Reagan Ranch. So with that dual acknowledgement, I want to make 3 points that are drawn from my dual perspective as a professor in the area of federal Indian law and also from my perspective as a justice of the Court of Appeals of the Hualapai Tribe in Arizona. First, I want to argue that recognizing tribal sovereignty is actually a way to fulfill American ideals. In fact, I think denying recognition to tribal sovereignty may well be a transgression of American democratic ideals. And to understand why, I think we have to turn back in time to the establishment of the United States and the creation of its Constitution. The foundational theory behind that document, I believe a theory that we adhere to this day, is that governments gain their legitimacy from the consent of the governed. Yet Native American tribes were not parties to the U.S. Constitution. And that's very evident from examining the document itself. There aren't many references to Indian tribes in the Constitution, but the few that exist are quite telling. The phrase "Indians not taxed" appears, and it is used to describe those Indians who are excluded from the apportionment of representatives to the U.S. House of Representatives. You may ask, who were the Indians who were taxed? Those were the Indians who had severed their tribal relations. So the Indians who maintained their tribal relations were characterized as outside the polity that was forming the United States government. In addition, within the U.S. Constitution, in the Commerce Clause, there is a reference to Congress's power to legislate regarding commerce with the Indian tribes, as well as commerce with foreign nations, and to deal with interstate commerce, clearly an acknowledgement of Indian nations as governments and as governments outside the framework of the United States. As Professor Skabeen has mentioned, citizenship was not even conferred upon American Indians until 1924, and I want to underscore that that was done without their petitioning or evident consent. So they were incorporated by the United States, in effect, unilaterally. And I would suggest to you that much of federal Indian law is actually a way to accommodate to this uncomfortable set of facts if you consider broader American democratic ideals. So that the doctrines in federal Indian law that you just heard about that are designed to recognize tribal sovereignty in statutes as well as court decisions, acknowledging tribal sovereign immunity, for example, are really a way to explain the existence of American power and incorporation of Indian tribes in light of the fact this was not something that they agreed to at the formation of our nation. And I always like to recall that in 1990, The United States declared war on Iraq because they had invaded another separate country, Kuwait. It was an expression of our view that there ought not to be this kind of forcible incorporation, and of course, Iraq was claiming that this was part of their territory. Obviously, much has happened since then. So that's my first point. My first point is that federal Indian law is really a way to acknowledge American democratic ideals in light of the way in which the United States has incorporated Indian territories and peoples into the country. The second point I want to make is that challenging tribal sovereignty in the name of American ideals is likely to be counterproductive if we look at history. And you've gotten a bit of this historical sweep in Professor Scavene's presentation, but I want to focus on two particular points in time, notably the late 19th century and the two decades following World War II. During these periods, the United States actively pursued policies that were designed to dissolve tribes as governments, eliminate the protected status of their lands, and forcibly assimilate Indian people through compulsory attendance at boarding schools and otherwise. These policies were known respectively as allotment and termination. And they were complete economic and social disasters for Indian people and later repudiated by the federal government. And interestingly enough, the repudiations occurred in two Republican administrations. It was the Hoover administration that produced a report known as the Merriam Report that showed the disastrous effects of allotment. And it was President Nixon in 1970, in an important statement he made to the nation, who repudiated the termination policy. At the time of both allotment and termination were put forward, they were justified in terms of advancing American ideals of individual autonomy and private property. But beware of such policies, because they have backfired in the past, and they will likely backfire if they're attempted again. And that's because Indian peoples have distinct cultures and spiritual beliefs that they still wish to perpetuate. In more than 500 treaties, they were promised that they could continue to do so forever, as long as the grass will grow. I don't know if that took into account global warming. And the project on American Indian Economic Development at Harvard has shown that strengthening tribal sovereignty is a very effective way to boost reservation economies. And by the way, I have a book that they've published, which is showing from the 2000 census that the average per capita income in 2000 was a little under $8,000 for reservation residents, compared with $21,000 for the United States as a whole. So for those individuals who want to sever relations or pursue a different way of life, there is ample opportunity outside of reservations in the United States. My point here is that much of contemporary federal Indian law is actually best understood as trying to rectify some of the harm and wreckage that was produced by allotment and termination policies. So when you see things like the Indian Child Welfare Act that give preference to placement of Indian children in Indian families, or you see provisions for taking land into trust to reconstruct tribal land bases, I think a very effective way to understand them is as ways of remedying the consequences of these harmful policies. And finally, my third point, and this is speaking largely as a tribal appellate court judge, I want to be clear about my concern for the human rights of individuals on reservations, as well as the human rights for indigenous peoples as groups. I do believe that Indian nations deserve to be measured by basic standards of human rights, rather than by the specific practices of particular states or even the federal government, particularly when Indian nations are taking coercive action through conventional non-Indian style criminal justice systems. Individual rights must be respected. Now, there is already a tremendous amount of constraint on the operation of tribal actions through their own bills of rights, through their traditions of respect for individuals, and through the Federal Indian Civil Rights Act of 1968, which both limits the punishments that Indian tribes may impose to to 6 months, excuse me, a year in jail or a $5,000 fine for any one offense. And also, the Indian Civil Rights Act imposes quite a few requirements to respect individual rights in the criminal justice system, although not all of those required by the U.S. Bill of Rights. So there's already a lot of constraint on them. And the federal government, as Professor Skabeen has noted, does claim the power to intervene even further if necessary. The biggest problem, I think, right now in Indian country is the provision of counsel at government expense for indigent defendants. I think that is a very serious concern. And part of the problem is that the federal government didn't require this because it didn't want to finance the cost of providing counsel. I think this ought to be a priority for federal support for tribes. And I think in the criminal justice area, as in many others, local control, which is a strong democratic American ideal, is a very effective strategy. We should strengthen local institutions on reservations to ensure that they will be respecting basic individual rights. So those are my 3 points, and I look forward to hearing from the others.
Thank you very much, Carol. We'll now hear from Joe Mattal. Joe?
When the judge first introduced me, I believe I caught that he said that I would talk about the jurisdictional impacts of doing contracts with Indian country. And it's actually not what I prepared. In any event, that'd be a pretty short statement. Basically, if you're doing a contract with a tribe or individuals in Indian country, make sure you have a choice of law and venue clause that says you go to state court or federal court. Otherwise, you can end up in tribal court to litigate one of these contracts. I was actually going to talk about the issue of civil rights in Indian country. The topic of this presentation is tribal sovereignty consistent with American ideals? And I think it comes down to, well, you know, what is the content of tribal sovereignty? What does it mean in practice? And you know, frankly, that's not a fixed thing. It's something that's, you know, been altered at various points. But just looking at it now, I think there's a clear case to be made that the system that Congress has set up now, and that the and especially the way the courts have interpreted it, is pretty sharply inconsistent with American ideals. The biggest gap, and I could give a whole presentation just on the impact that tribal sovereignty has on non-Indians living near Indian communities. There are often pretty severe impacts to living right next to a community that's not governed by the same laws you are in terms of zoning, what kinds of businesses can be built right next to your house, traffic. But right now I'm just going to focus on the impact on Indians. Professor Goldberg mentioned the Indian Civil Rights Act. This was adopted in 1968, and it extended most, not all, but most of the Bill of Rights to the Indian tribes. Prior to this decision, the courts had held, at least since the late 19th century, that Indian tribes are entities that exist outside the context of the Constitution. They're neither a state nor a federal government. And the Constitution, including its Bill of Rights, does not by its own force apply to Indian tribes. This would come up in the context of someone trying to challenge something a tribe did. And the answer was, you know, the Fifth Amendment, everything else in the Bill of Rights just doesn't apply. As a remedy, in 1968, Congress adopted ICRA. And there are a few exceptions in ICRA. I believe the Equal Protection Clause doesn't apply because that would obviously create problems with, you know, just tribal membership. Tribal membership is invariably based on, to some extent, on race and ancestry, and they didn't want to get into troubles with that. They also didn't extend the Establishment Clause. My understanding is that the original draft did, and the Pueblos of New Mexico came to Congress and said, wait, we're a theocracy. You know, if you do this, you know, we can't, you know, maintain our government. And so for, you know, to accommodate the Pueblos, they left that out. You know, technically a tribe, I guess, could, you know, if they all converted to Islam, they could have a Sharia state. But it's never come up, and it's never really been a problem. The real issue is with the rest of the Bill of Rights. So we passed ICRA in 1968. That solves the problem, right? Problem is about 10 years later in 1978, the Supreme Court ruled, well, the law applies, but Congress created no cause of action for enforcing it. The basic habeas law guaranteed by the Constitution still applies. So if you're actually imprisoned by a tribe, you can bring a habeas action in federal court. But there's no other cause of action, Section 1983, all of your standard vehicles. So it's a law that's not enforceable in any federal or state court. So where do you go to enforce ICRA if you're a tribal member and you feel like your rights have been violated? You go to tribal court. And the problem is that with over 560-odd reservations around the country, there's tremendous variety in the character of tribal governments. First of all, there's no requirement for separation of powers in tribal governments. And in fact, most of them have a tribal council and a leader, and most of them don't have any separation of powers. Sometimes in your judicial system, the person you make an appeal to is the same tribal council that issued the laws that that you're challenging or took the actions that you're challenging. Or often you'll have a tribal judge who hears these cases, but he serves at the pleasure of the chief of the tribe. You know, what happens if you sue the chief and this judge rules against you? He can be fired the next day. And all of these things have happened happened to people. The illustration I use with people is, imagine if rural whites living in some part of the country said, we want to set up our own government, and we don't want to be subject to the Bill of Rights. Just let us make our own laws and be ruled by them. What do you think would happen? Indians are people too, and subject to the same vices as other human beings. And you get tribes and governments that get greedy or don't always treat their people the way they ought to. And I'd like to just bring into relief what this means in practical reality, that you don't have an enforceable mechanism for enforcing the Bill of Rights. And I think all of us would agree that to get back to the theme of the conference, that if there's anything that should exemplify the American ideals, it's the Bill of Rights. These are the things we fought a revolution over, and everyone is pretty consistently agreed to. These are our highest ideals. What does it matter? What does it mean when these things don't exist? In the context of the First Amendment, there's no First Amendment right enforceable outside of the tribal government itself. There have been cases where editors of tribal newspapers and other newspapers have been excluded from a reservation or excluded from covering an activity. There have been, and in many cases, usually actually, the tribal paper is owned by the tribe itself. So if the editor of the paper starts writing about corruption or controversies on the reservation, he'll just be fired. If he criticizes the tribal council, his budget will be cut. And you have no appeal of this outside of literally the tribal council itself. In terms of due process, Fifth Amendment due process, how would you feel if you were suing your local police chief? You feel like you were abused by a police officer, and you go before a judge, and that judge serves at the pleasure of the chief or the mayor. What kind of due process is that? But that's literally what many Indians have to live with. Another consequence is that in much of Indian country, there's no stable property rights. Now, again, there are tribes, cite the Navajo in Arizona, for example, who have a more stable adjudicative system, judges who serve for fixed terms, et cetera. But a lot of Indian reservations are very small, just a few thousand people, and sometimes a lot less. And, there's no, institutional, stability that builds up in these things. What do you think it would mean for you if you really had no enforceable property rights, no, Fifth Amendment takings right, anything like that against, against your local government? There's really nothing to prevent the tribe from, taxing you out of existence or regulating you out of existence or, frankly, even if your land is just taken. Just imagine if you couldn't appeal outside of the structure of the entity that did this to you. And some recent incidents that have really brought these contexts into sharp relief involve some of the membership disputes with tribes. From the last decade, there are two fairly infamous incidents involving the Seminole and Cherokee tribes of Oklahoma. Both of these tribes were forced into Oklahoma in Trail of Tears type situations, the Seminoles from Florida, and both of them historically had black members that came with them. The Seminoles are actually an amalgam of different tribes that were in Florida that, you know, came together and lived together. Florida was, you know, still part of Spain until 1819. And escaped slaves and other Africans joined this group. They were removed from Florida to Oklahoma in the 1840s. And at some point in the 90s, the Seminoles came into a substantial settlement over land claims in Florida with the federal government. And they were going to divvy that settlement out to members in terms of various benefits you get, you know, clothes for your kids, health care, things like that. And in the late 90s, the Seminoles decided, you know what, it's time to figure out who's really a Seminole. And they expelled all their black members. The Cherokees, around the same time, did the same thing. In their case, there was a political dispute, and the black members sided with a dissident faction that tried to defeat the tribal government in an election. They lost. And the victors in that election retaliated and did the same thing. And, you know, these black members said, you know, this is outrageous. This is the United States. You know, you can't do this to us. And one of the, I believe this was one of the Cherokee tribes chiefs was asked, this is the Seminoles, was asked, well, look, there are actually even treaties that your tribe signed with the United States after the Civil War, you know, in 1866, that required you to treat the black members equally. Of course, that treaty, like most treaties, is non-self-executing, meaning there's no cause of action to bring it into court. And the chief was asked about this in the late 90s or earlier this decade, and he said, we recognize blacks as people who needed a right to participate because the government says that's the way it'll be, said Keith Chenoweth Chambers. In 1866, we got the crap kicked out of us for fighting for the... And then there's even been litigation where the black members have tried to sue the BIA, the federal government, and said, look, you can't allocate the benefits that you're giving to the tribe based on these racially discriminatory exclusions. And the BIA and the tribe have successfully barred those lawsuits on the ground that the tribe is an indispensable and necessary party to that suit, and so you can't sue the BIA without without interfering in this.
Joe, could you conclude your opening remarks, please?
Lots of other stories to tell, but in conclusion, I'd say that the Bill of Rights is the highest of American ideals, and if we continue to allow it to be unenforceable in Indian country, tribal sovereignty becomes incompatible with American ideals.
Thank you very much, Joe. We'll hear now from Dan Conkey. Dan?
First, it's a real pleasure and inspiration to be here at the invitation of the Federal Society and here in this wonderful presidential library. Winston Churchill once said of Clement Attlee that he had the uncanny ability of compressing so many words into so few thoughts. Now, with only 5 to 8 minutes to make this presentation, I will have to compress so many thoughts into so few words. So, here I go. First, Carol is quite right that tribal sovereignty is consistent with the Constitution since the tribes were largely outside that constitutional system. However, as the role of tribal governments, federal government, state governments, and local governments have developed from a often tragic historic process, there has not been the sort of rationality that has allowed a constitutionally principled arrangement to be established between tribal governments, state governments, and local governments. And let me give you some particular points of that in the context of the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act. As you know, under the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, tribes can negotiate compacts with states that allow them to engage in casino-style gaming. Under the Act, a tribe can conduct any type of gaming that is permitted within the state to any person for any purpose. Therefore, the state of Connecticut, which allowed charities to operate Las Vegas nights in infrequent occasions with particular wager limits, as a result of that, the state of Connecticut had to allow tribes to engage in Las Vegas nights and Las Vegas days every day of the week because it permitted a charity, at least infrequently to engage in these Las Vegas nights. The state of California in 1984 adopted a state lottery. And as you know, in California, you go to a supermarket or 7-Eleven, you can find a lottery machine there. But the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act means that a tribe can have rows and rows of lottery games and lottery devices in basically a casino setting, even though the same act that adopted a state lottery in 1984 prohibited any private lotteries and prohibited casinos of the type operating in Nevada and New Jersey. The California Constitution actually has a prohibition that says that casinos of the type operating in Nevada and New Jersey are prohibited to be established by the state legislature. But here in California, we now have over 40 casinos of the type operating in Nevada and New Jersey in a constitutional framework that prohibits such casinos. So point one is, in terms of a relationship between tribal governments and state governments, state public policy to prohibit casinos is undermined given that you have tribal sovereignties within the state. Point two, normally if you have an enterprise within a state, that enterprise will hire residents or citizens of that state to operate within that commercial enterprise. But with tribal casinos, most of those casinos are hiring not residents or citizens of the tribe, but most of the workers come from outside the tribal reservation. They're residents and citizens of the state, which is fine, but normally a worker can influence the laws governing the worker's treatment through the worker's influence on the state legislature. But, of course, that's not the case with respect to state citizens working at a tribal casino. And, indeed, Judge Janice Rogers Brown, in a case, San Manuel Bingo and Casino versus NLRB, that found that the National Labor Relations Act could be applied to tribal casinos as it was not an infringement on their sovereignty, also said that probably no member of Congress imagined that a small Indian tribe could operate like a closely held corporation employing hundreds or even thousands of non-Indians to produce a product it profitably marketed to non-Indians. Point three, normally in a state that has a commercial enterprise, the patrons that come to that enterprise are largely going to be citizens or residents of the state, and again, they have the ability to influence the legislature as to their treatment at that enterprise. All kinds of consumer protection laws that can be established and influenced if the enterprises seem to be going too far in one direction. But again, with a tribal enterprise, most of the patrons are coming from outside the tribal reservation, and they have no right to influence what laws govern their treatment at the tribal enterprise. Next point, sovereign immunity. Even a foreign government that operates a commercial enterprise, say, in the United States, waives its sovereign immunity from suit with respect to those commercial activities. Indeed, a foreign government even waives its sovereign immunity with respect to acts that occur outside of its territory and outside the United States that has an effect within the United States as long as it is related to commercial enterprise. That's under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. But tribes don't have any such waiver of their sovereign immunity and are immune from suit with respect to anything arises out of a tribal casino, unless, of course, they've agreed to waive that sovereign immunity. In a U.S. Supreme Court case, Kiowa Tribe of Oklahoma versus Manufacturing Technologies, the tribe made a purchase of stock from Manufacturing Technologies, and in return, the tribe gave a promissory note of $285,000 for the stock. The tribe then defaulted on the note, and, of course, Manufacturing Technologies sued to recover the failed payment. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled that there was a federal common law of sovereign immunity that applied to tribal governments, and while it was a federal common law principle that may not make much sense in retaining, that the court would defer to Congress making that determination rather than the court, and the claim was denied. And indeed, that sovereign immunity extends not just to the tribe, but to corporations chartered under the tribe's laws. And indeed, a recent Ninth Circuit case, Cook versus AVI Casino Enterprises, ruled that the employees, not just the officials, but employees of the tribal corporation are also immune from suit. So you have this dichotomy again in terms of relationships between state, local, and tribal governments in terms of the ability to bring suit with respect to the conduct of tribal governments that are engaged in commercial enterprises. So where does one go from here? And this here is where I sum up. Where does one go from here in terms of trying to develop a more rational system of relationships between tribal, state, and local governments, given that this relationship has simply evolved, as I said at the outset, from an often tragic historical process, but there is some room for some rational fixes in terms of these relationships. Now, one thing that has been done is compacts between local governments or state governments and the tribal governments. Those compacts can provide for a set of rules in connection with a commercial enterprise or in connection with another type of activity. The only difficulty with compacts is that there has to be an incentive on both sides to negotiate the compact. The Indian Gaming Regulatory Act attempted to set up that set of incentives by providing that tribes could not game unless they had a compact with respect to casino gaming, and that the state had an obligation to negotiate in good faith for such compacts. That has broken down somewhat, although not in California, but it's broken down somewhat because of a U.S. Supreme Court decision that held that the states could not be sued for failure to act in good faith because the states had an 11th Amendment right in terms of their own sovereign immunity. And I won't go into that any further here. Point two is there are some things that could be done in terms of applying international law principles to tribal-state relationships. And again, I won't say anything more about that at this point. Three is Congress could do something about the issue of sovereign immunity, not in terms of a broad waiver. And by the way, the U.S. Supreme Court cases do say that one has to distinguish between tribal sovereign government, which tribes clearly are sovereigns, and sovereign immunity, which is simply one facet of sovereignty, which can be waived. Congress could look to some types of waivers in some instances for some commercial enterprises, and indeed, in the same case that the U.S. Supreme Court held the tribal sovereignty would be retained in that case where the default of a promissory note took place, the court also said, in our interdependent and mobile society, however, tribal immunity extends beyond what is needed to safeguard tribal self-governance. This is evident when tribes take part in the nation's commerce. Tribal enterprises now include ski resorts, gambling, and sales of cigarettes to non-Indians. In this economic context, immunity can harm those who are unaware that they are dealing with a tribe, who do not know of tribal immunity, or have no choice in the matter, as in the case of tort victims. So Congress could do something. Indeed, Judge Gold from the Ninth Circuit recently in this AVI case, Cook versus AVI, even implored the Supreme Court to move its doctrine to some sort of waiver of sovereign immunity as to some types of commercial enterprises. And finally, there could be something done with respect to making campaign contributions by tribes more transparent and in a way that accords with state public policy. And I'll leave it at that. There was a case in California that dealt with that.
All right. Thank you very much, Tom. We have two remaining speakers. We haven't quite abided with the 5 to 8 minute rule, but I must say that the presentations that we've heard so far are fascinating, very, very informative, and very, very helpful, and I'm sure we'll generate some questions when we come to that phase, hopefully fairly soon. Next speaker is Tom Sansonetti. Tom?
Yes, I too am very glad to have had the opportunity to come and visit with everyone today here at the Ronald Reagan Library. I apologize for a bit of a cold I've got here. My topics today are to give you, first of all, the perspective from which I'm coming to speak to you today, a theme that I would propose to you, and then some predictions as we look into the beginning of the Obama administration. First, the perspective that I bring to you today is that I happen to work for the law firm of Holland and Hart. We've got offices in the 7 Rocky Mountain states. We represent only companies on Indian reservations in those 7 states, largely in the energy industry. Otherwise, there would be just too many conflicts. On the other hand, outside those 7 states, we do represent Indian tribes. I happen to represent 3 tribes, one in the state of New York, Oregon, and here in California. During my tenure as the solicitor of the Department of the Interior under the first Bush administration, it was my responsibility to uphold the decisions of the Department of the Interior that concerned the trust responsibility owed to the Indian tribes throughout the United States. We administered the very first regulations that dealt with the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, which was passed there at the end of the 1980s, and authored opinions in regard to the status of Native Hawaiians and the Native Alaskan individuals. Later, from 2001 to 2005, as the Assistant Attorney General, the Department of Justice, responsible for the Environment and Natural Resources Division, I ended up defending in court President Bush's policies and those policies of the Interior Secretary Gail Norton for the entire 4 years of the first term of the administration. And I've had a chance to argue on behalf of the United States in a number of different circuit courts on behalf of the United States. My theme today is that it is time for the legislative branch to get reinvolved in the Indian world. Congress's inaction has led to the Indian law as we know it today being made on a temporary basis that switches back and forth from administration to administration, from Secretary of the Interior to Secretary of the Interior, by a rather unsure executive branch, or ultimately, Indian law today is being made by the judicial branch. Congress, as Professor Scabeen so well pointed out, seems to get involved, but only every 30 or 40 years. When they pass some grand law, and I'm saying that it's time for them to reengage. You saw how they've gone through the treaty era, the Guardian Ward era, the assimilation era, the 1934 Indian Reorganization Act era, the allotment era, the termination period, and now we're in the self-determination era, which deals with this expansive view of Indian sovereignty. I would note that when you look at what's happened as you go from these swings back and forth, that ultimately, as we sit here today in 2009, old John Marshall still has it right. We are still in a situation where there are domestic dependent nations, and they are torn between a desire for full sovereignty when things are going well, but they fall back on the federal government's trust responsibility when things are going wrong. Unemployment is still very, very high on way too many Indian reservations. Health care is poor. Education is poor. The dollars that come in from the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act are not always translated into reservation infrastructure improvements and into educational needs. Sometimes yes, most times not. There is, in many cases, nothing on the reservation for folks to come back to if a particular Indian student has gone off-reservation to college or the military and gained a professional skill. These problems still exist today. If the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and I know very, very many of the folks that work within that organization, and I respect them, but the job that they've been given many is an impossible task. If the BIA were a corporation, very few of the people in this room would own stock in it. You look at the entire budget of the Department of the Interior. The largest segment of the 8 agencies in the Department of the Interior, this includes things like the National Park Service, Fish and Wildlife Service, Bureau of Land Management, the Bureau of Reclamation, the largest piece of pie at the Department of the Interior goes to the NIA. And that came much to the surprise of Secretary Gail Norton when I first became her attorney in 2001. My prediction is that we are about 5 years away or so from Congress stepping back into the fray. There's going to be pressure building here. Part of it's the convergence of all the concerns over the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act as that spreads throughout the United States. But there are going to be clashes with expansive Indian sovereignty with the new Obama energy policy. There are going to be clashes that develop over regulatory jurisdiction and, again, many tribes' current expansive sovereignty push. My analogy to you is that when the Endangered Species Act first came out, it was largely applied to the 14 Western public land states. I had the opportunity when I was solicitor to be the general counsel for the God Squad hearings in Portland concerning the spotted owl. And everyone was concerned about that if you were in Oregon or if you were in the state of Washington or Idaho. And the endangered species, plants and animals, as they spread, concerned Western senators, and those are the type of folks that came to see me about their concerns. But now, as the Endangered Species Act has developed from 300 to 500 animals and plants to well over 1,200, there are senators and people concerned about the impact of the ESA all over the United States. Well, that's what's going to be happening here in this Indian world. Concerning the IGRA situation, folks in now approximately two-thirds of the states have been affected economically and socially by IGRA, and I think that there's pressure building from all over the United States for IGRA reform. Now, Obama's energy policy is going to require transmission corridors that will have to cross, in many instances, Indian lands. There are only a handful of states that don't have federally recognized Indian tribes right now. And so those transmission lines, whether they be pipelines or overhead electrical lines, railroads, whatever, are going to have to either be built around Indian lands if the cost of the right-of-ways is too high, or there's going to have to be eminent domain described, prescribed by Congress. Right now, that is not the case. So whether the domestic energy production is increased renewables that we all hear about, solar, wind, geothermal, traditional oil and gas, or even dirty coal, the energy-producing states must be able to get that product to market via pipeline, as I mentioned, lines of the railway. So the sovereignty battles, the battles over sovereignty, you can't come through my territory unless you pay me X, are going to increase exponentially, particularly now that we've got some 562 tribes, admittedly the great majority of them in California or Alaska. But look at a map. There is a publication I read every week called Indian Country Today. And Indian Country Today shows on its front page a picture of the United States in 1492. It says Indian Country, and all of the United States is painted red. And underneath there it says Indian Country Today, 2009. And, of course, you look at the picture, and there are splotches of red in the rest of it, different colors. But the splotches of those red are included almost all over the United States. So there are going to be situations where we are going to see some clashes between our energy domestic needs and the sovereignty requirements of Indian nations. Now, some people say, well, hey, if federal government approves a pipeline to take natural gas from Wyoming to a growing area like Las Vegas, if they want to come through my backyard or through state territory, they pay fair market value. And if people complain about how much I'm being offered, go to court, and the judge decides what the fair market value of my ranch was that they just tore up. Well, that's not going to be the case when you have a situation where you have sovereign immunity on behalf of the tribes. So we're going to hopefully discuss a number of these things in our Q&A, but I want you just to note how many of the top topics today are actually in the court system because of fights between either two tribes against each other or situations with state and tribes. And you will see that most of Indian law today is being made out of the circuit courts of appeal and ultimately the Supreme Court. So in conclusion, I say that either Congress steps in and set the limits of Indian sovereignty, or the judicial branch is going to do so one case at a time, because the executive branch is unfocused, it is uncoordinated, and it shifts policies on Indian law from administration to administration. So the plenary power of Congress needs to be asserted.
Thank you very much, Tom. Our last panel speaker will be actually the same as our first panel speaker. Alex Cabin will offer a few observations briefly on some of the comments.
Thank you. And I have.
And then we'll go to questions.
I have about 4 points that I'm going to cover in 2 minutes. First, I agree with Tom Cincinnati that perhaps the executive is in disarray, but I would also say that the Congress is in disarray also concerning Indian policy. I've agreed with much of what the speaker have said. When I first came here, you know, this is the Federal Society, and my most valuable colleague at the University of Utah was Michael McConnell, or still is, but now he's a Ninth Circuit judge. He spends much less time there. And the other valuable colleague I have is Paul Cassell, used to be a federal judge and also a member of the society. And I remember I asked Michael, you know, before he became a judge, so, you know, what would a conservative court or a conservative jurist like about Indian tribes and Indian law? And he always had an answer for everything, but this time he just looked at me and he said, let me think about it, and I'll get back to you. And, of course, before he got back to me, he got to be a judge, and now he doesn't automatically express those feelings. But anyway, so there's a couple of things. First, you know, principles of federalism, I think it really means the baseline is that decision affecting the people in a particular area should be made by local people, by local governments. The principle of devolution from the bigger government to the small. And I think that fits the tribe. Also, number two, is a question of this whole issue of plenary power of Congress over Indian tribes that the court says now is derived basically solely from the Commerce Clause is really not, does not respect originalism in constitutional interpretation. So as a result, I think that those two principles, conservative jurists could agree at least with that there is some issues with Indian tribes. Number two, I think that Dan Kolke made a very good point concerning the fact Indian tribes were outside of the federal government. And, the treaty, for 100 years, they were outside. And then there was a progressive integration or a progressive incorporation into the American political system. But it was not guided, really, by rhyme or reasons. I think it was guided, you know, in 1871, we end treaty making and stuff like this. It was acts of Congress here and there. And it was mostly, as Tom Cincinnati said, really by judicial decision, you know, based on the earth. But there was no, you know, rhyme of reason to how tribes became incorporated in the American political system. In effect, there should have been a constitutional amendment like they have in Canada. You know, maybe it would have been passed in 1871, maybe in 1934, but it was not. Instead, really, except for the few acts of Congress, really, it's the trust doctrine that, in effect, integrates Indian tribes into the American political system. The problem with the trust doctrine is that the states are out of it. You know, it's an exclusive relationship between the trustee, you know, Indians used to call it the Great White Father, and the tribes. And there's a problem with this because ultimately Indian tribes now are within the states where they are located. They have to deal with state governments. And as was said, you know, there is no process that has been there. So, you know, it results in a lot of indeterminacy in the law. Now, some of us, that's good for us, law professors, and it's good for some of you guys lawyers. It's not automatically good for your business friends or the individual people that have to hire you. So the next thing is, you know, how can we solve this short of a constitutional amendment, which is very hard to pass? The compact model in IGRA, and this is where, you know, I'm going to disagree probably with Dan concerning IGRA. When IGRA was first passed in 1988, you know, I was working for the Congress, and I was one of the staff, few staff, that actually wrote the act. And I remember when we finally passed the act, all the Indian tribes were against it. And I went to some of those meetings after the act was passed, and I had to basically duck under the table sometimes because they were throwing things at me, and, you know, and some unpleasant things were said. And I remember one time I told those tribal leaders, well, you know, Udall is your friend, but with friends like this, who likes enemies? And of course, they didn't take that kindly since I was about 30 years old, and so you can't say stuff like that to older people. Anyway, so ultimately what I think that, you know, if you hear that, you know, IGRA was bad from the Indian tribes, and then you hear the state side from Dan Kolke that, oh, no, there's some problems with IGRA, that perhaps, just perhaps, we hit a balance, you know, between the tribal and the state interest, and you know, it's not, like any legislation, it's a bargain, it's not perfect, but the fact that I've heard and had to defend IGRA against both the tribes and the state interest means that maybe there is a balance there. You know, one of the things we could do is basically adopt this model, you know, for each tribe and state. And, you know, at one point I've advocated maybe we should look at the Puerto Rican model. You know, they have a commonwealth status, and that maybe the tribes should have the same thing. The problem, of course, is that Puerto Rico is not within a greater state, and each tribe, the tribes are. So we would have to include the states in those negotiations over a more firm, compact model. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much to our panel. We're going to take questions from the floor in just another moment. I have one or two questions I thought I would ask the panel, although first I want to give them an opportunity. Do the panel members have any questions or comments they want to make in response to comments that were made by their fellow panel members? Yes, Carol?
I think it takes a few seconds for this to turn on.
There you go.
There we go. Well, I have a special interest, again, in my capacity as a tribal court judge as well as a law professor, in some of the issues that have been raised about the fairness of tribes' governmental actions and judicial proceedings. And I wanted to make a couple of observations. First is that the structure of many contemporary tribal governments is actually the product of a lot of prodding and influence by the U.S. government, some of it well-intentioned. In the 1930s, during the period of the Indian New Deal, the Department of the Interior was promoting the establishment of constitutions by tribal governments, most of which did not have them. The constitutions that were put forward did not include provisions for separation of powers. These constitutions did typically subsume the judiciary under the tribal council and did not create a separate executive branch. There's a reason why these constitutions were put forward in this form, and one of them is that the Department of the Interior thought it would be easier to exercise influence and control over tribal governments if they didn't have to deal with complex entities that included checks and balances. Well, the consequences of having this type of constitution have been problematic for many tribes. And it is very common today to see organizations working within Indian country and universities, such as our clinic at UCLA, working on tribal constitutional revision to try to establish more in the way of separation of powers, precisely because this type of centralized government that was encouraged by the United States is not necessarily typical of the ways tribes govern themselves. They had very substantial mechanisms for check and balance within their more traditional governing systems, sometimes because they govern by consensus, which gives lots of check to what you can do. You can't do anything unless you can get a large-scale agreement within the community, but also because there were divisions between war and peace societies, between spiritual leaders and more day-to-day leaders. And those kinds of divisions and checks within tribal governments were eradicated by these constitutions that were put forward during the Indian Reorganization Act period of the Indian New Deal. So I think there is a movement underway within Indian country to strengthen the institutions that are functioning in times of conflict within communities. But I think we also need to be clear that there are ways of resolving problems within tribal communities that don't operate on the adversarial model that is typical within the non-Indian society, so that when outsiders look upon tribes and they say, well, somebody's got a claim and they're not able to adjudicate it in a typical adversarial fashion, that may not be the way tribes resolve issues within their community. Many tribes, especially in Southern California, deal through general councils where the tribal community as a whole gets together, lets everybody have their say, and then they collectively resolve the problem. So I think we need to be wary of imposing institutions because there have been problems with it in the past, and because the best way to work out these problems is by encouraging forces that are already underway within tribal communities.
Any other comments from panel members? Yes, Joe Matan.
You know, I would just add, you know, in addition to the lack of is this on? Yeah. In addition to the lack of separation of powers, one problem with a lot of tribes is they're very small. Often it's, you know, you can get just a few hundred people or sometimes even less being a tribe. And one phenomenon you'll see in tribal elections is that people vote along family-based lines. This has actually come out in a couple of California cases where tribes that have gotten quite wealthy from casino revenue and that divide the revenue up among their members have disenrolled members. You know, basically, if you kick some people out, there's more money. You know, the pot is split fewer ways, and you know, you'll often see families uniting against each other and different clans agreeing to vote out a less powerful clan. And there's a rather just one more anecdote. There's a rather infamous case in California where a tribe decided to vote out a particular clan because they decided a woman who was fairly high up in the ancestry of the tribe wasn't actually an Indian. And they did all kinds of anthropological research, and that didn't persuade the tribe. And the tribe finally suggested DNA testing. They actually had to exhume the bodies of these two women to prove one was the daughter of the other. And they did three different DNA tests, proved to the usual DNA numbers, 99.87%, et cetera, that the two were related. And the tribe said, it's not 100%. You haven't met your burden of proof in this case. And they actually denied the claim. So, when you get institutions that are this small, even if you did have a rigorous system of separation of powers, there's still a case for some kind of outside oversight to make sure that what are often just family squabbles don't end up deciding fundamental issues like who gets to be part of the tribe and share in a gambling revenue.
Well, I think the time has come to take questions from the floor, and the floor is open, starting with this gentleman here. I don't know, do we have a roaming mic that can help for this, or just do your best to be heard?
From your point of view, as a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee staff, is there any legislation that is brewing or is likely to be brewing to address any of the problems that you've been talking about?
There's definitely legislation brewing. I was thinking of this when Tom Sansonetti mentioned, Congress really needs to step in. Be careful what you ask for. A lot of the legislation I've seen, first of all, there are efforts to recognize new tribes, the Native Hawaiians, which would be about a 200,000-person tribe. There's an effort to recognize about half a dozen new tribes in the state of Virginia, a large tribe called the Lumbees in North Carolina seeking recognition. There have also been a couple of efforts to basically give tribes jurisdiction over non-Indians, which raises a whole host of other issues because tribes are inherently ethnically or racially defined, or at least based on ancestry. And you can just imagine the potential for abuse if they have jurisdiction over people who are racially excluded. Often there's a lot of animosity between different communities too. So those are the kinds of things that are in the pipeline in Congress. Frankly, I think we'd be better off based on what I've seen, if Congress does nothing for the while.
Tom, did you have a follow-up?
I did. I would just like to alert the gentleman and those in the audience to keep your eye on a Supreme Court case. It is called Carcieri versus Kempthorne. Carcieri is the present Republican governor of Rhode Island, obviously Kempthorne, the just recently departed Secretary of the Interior. The case was initially called Rhode Island versus Gail Norton. I argued the case in the First Circuit Court of Appeals. It was argued before the U.S. Supreme Court on November the 3rd. Ted Olson, our former Solicitor General, actually argued on behalf of the state of Rhode Island. The decision is expected in February. I predict that that case is, I was in the courtroom during the oral argument for the Supreme Court, I predict that Carcieri is going to win. the tribe that Kim Thorne Norton had given some land to in trust was the Narragansett tribe. And the case is going to hinge on the fact that the 1934 act that Professor Scabene was telling us about, the Indian Reorganization Act, allowed and permitted the government to take land into trust, that is to put land that is not inside necessarily a reservation at a given time and make it part of Indian country for Indian gaming or whatever the purpose is. And I believe that the Supreme Court is going to say, you know, that's right, that the federal government was given permission to go ahead and take land into trust for tribes, but only for those with which the federal government had a relationship as of 1934. They didn't say they could go ahead and take land into trust for some tribe that came into existence in 1982 or 2009, like the ones that Joe was referring these new potential bills coming up, making new tribes in Virginia. And so if that's the case, then you will be back in Congress, because every tribe that has obtained any land since 1934 that was not in existence in 1934, all of a sudden any land that they had been given all this time was, frankly, the state's land. They may have possessed it, but it would have been subject to the jurisdiction of the county and states concerned. And consequently, that is all property that has been untaxed. People obviously are going to be owing some tax money. So keep an eye on Carcieri versus Kim Thorne and its result. Next month, it will be giving Joe something to do.
Okay. Joe, did you have Dan, did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, just on this point of congressional action, my experience has been that it's very hard to get congressional action on issues involving tribal governments. Back in the early 90s, when I was with Governor Pete Wilson's administration, we were trying to get some very modest changes to the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, one of which was simply to, as I mentioned before, the state is obligated to negotiate in good faith over a compact to allow gaming with the tribe. The tribe does not have a good faith obligation in return. There's a different balance. But we thought that it would actually help negotiations if both the tribe and the state had a good faith obligation to negotiate. And we couldn't even get that done through Congress because of tribal opposition. On the other hand, to show what can happen, and Joe alluded to this, a midnight bill by Congressman George Miller, where he added a completely separate point to another bill, gave a tribe on the way to San Francisco on the 80 freeway a tribal land that was made by congressional act eligible for Class 3 gaming right near the Bay Area, San Pablo, which, of course, would have, and in fact, as the tribe did get that, but that created a huge problem because it would have been about the only California tribal casino that would have been really within an urban area. And, you know, one of the things about the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act is that the tribes in some ways have more of a monopoly on gaming, but in other ways they need it because if the gaming is limited to their reservation, they would not be able to compete if they didn't have a monopoly against those who can find a location in an urban area.
Years has often been the consequence of tribes bringing land claims for deprivation of lands in violation of federal law. And so Congress was engaging in federal recognition as a way of resolving these land claims. Other forms of statutory recognition have been to restore tribes to federal recognition that were terminated during that period in the 1950s that was repudiated in President Nixon's statement. So the existence of federal recognition is not the same thing as the creation of a tribe. And indeed, there's a regulatory process through the Department of the Interior for federal recognition as well. But I can assure you that the process of proof required to establish federal recognition under those regulations is exceedingly onerous, very expensive, takes tribes decades if they're successful, and very few have been. And the reason it's so difficult is that you have to prove your continuous existence politically and socially as a tribe for more than 100 years. So tribes aren't being fabricated out of nothing. That's what I want to be clear about.
Next question from the floor. Yes, right over here.
Yes, Ms. Goldberg, you mentioned coercion as the theme of Native governments that did not choose to be a part of the United States. That's also true for anybody who was born here, didn't immigrate here, didn't know the citizenship. By that same token, should anybody who has not taken over citizenship or explicitly recognized the authority of the local, state, federal government be allowed to have a separate government themselves?
The theory of consent does not require the continued consent of each generation, but it presupposes at some point in one's ancestry that consent having been given through immigration or otherwise. The hard case I thought you were going to talk about was the case of African slaves who were brought to this country. And I think what is demonstrated in the case of African Americans is a continued effort on their part to achieve incorporation. I mean, they have been actively seeking equal treatment, basically the integration into American society. It's been the consistent position of Native American tribes that they want to maintain themselves as distinct communities. And I think that's what's different about that situation.
Yes.
I have a question for Mr. Antonetti. You mentioned that under the Obama administration, we may see some problems with utilities and connecting them across tribal lands. I was curious if the federal government has ever attempted to use eminent domain on tribal lands and what the result of that was, and if you're aware of any states that have tried to use it, and what the result of that was.
Federal government, yes. Many of our nation's railroads were constructed, of course, during the 19th century with the benefit of eminent domain that crossed everybody's land. Same thing happened during the Eisenhower era when we came out with our federal highway system. Congress declared, we're going through from point A to point B, and devil take the hindmost. You'll get paid your fair market value, but that's the way it's going to be. States, no, because the states right now, if you wanted to take a chunk of the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming, my home state, the fact would be that the state couldn't sue successfully the Indian tribes through the Arapaho and Shoshone in a state district court, just as the Wind River tribe may try and sue the state of Wyoming in tribal court. The state of Wyoming is not going to show. I think one of the most important things that maybe people in the audience need to know is the structure of the decision-making, though, because you said Obama administration. It's interesting to note we all can put our finger on a decision concerning Indian law made in the judicial branch. We have a federal district judge's name. We have a circuit court of appeals, 3-person panel, Supreme Court. If laws are passed or not passed where Joe works, then we know the identity of the 100 senators making that policy, the 435 Congress folks. But how many folks are actually making the cuts on the topics that we're talking about today in the executive branch? The truth of the matter is, if you really look at it, say, well, you know, President Obama can make all this. Well, of course he could. But in reality, having served in 3 administrations, what I see is that you have got a director of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, a political appointee. You have got an assistant secretary of Indian Affairs, presidential appointee confirmed by the Senate, that are the 2 key political individuals over top of groups of all career folks that must do their policy bidding. In the solicitor's office, you've got a career associate solicitor. As of November the 13th, used to be a political position, it's now career. You have 2 people in a 425-person law firm, the Office of the Solicitor, that are political appointees, the power to make those kind of policy decisions. That's the deputy solicitor and the solicitor. And Carol is exactly right in her comments about how tough it is to become a new tribe and how you have to go through all the ancestry, filing all the documents. But if you actually dig down into the building there on the fourth floor and interior as to who actually is in that pod of people that make those cuts, there are eight people in the Bureau of Indian Affairs that have got the majority of the work, and there are four attorneys in the Division of Indian Affairs assigned to help them out. That's part of the problem. There's just not enough people to handle the thing. But in general, there are approximately five people in each administration that handle 90% of the policies, whether it's gaming, Indian education, Indian health, and all that. So you got to find out who makes the decisions, and that helps you understand the way the policies go.
Judge, I'd love to respond to the question about the impact of the rights-of-way on communities, because the Hualapai Tribe of Arizona is a very good example. For those of you who aren't familiar with it, the Hualapai Tribe sits on top of the south rim of the Grand Canyon. And the Santa Fe Pacific Railroad has a right-of-way that goes right through the reservation. In fact, the tribe did as an economic development project the construction of a lodge, because they do rafting trips along the Colorado River, and I would encourage all of you to come to Hualapai and take a rafting trip. However, when you check into the Hualapai Lodge, you have to be issued, if you're going to be on one side of the lodge, the one facing the railroad tracks, earplugs. I don't know if anybody's ever been there, but that's what you have to do, because several times during the night, the train comes rushing through. The tracks are right across the main road that separates the lodge from all the Hualapai tribal government buildings, which means that there are times when the trains get stopped right in that crossway. And business stops on the Hualapai reservation because you can't get from one side to the other. So if you want to know, have these rights-of-ways had a major impact? Absolutely yes. And safety issues exist because of this train rushing through the reservation, and great difficulty, I might add, on the part of the Hualapai tribe in trying to have any control whatsoever over what happens with the railroad, because rights-of-ways, although they are still part of the reservation under federal law, are not subject to tribal control under a series of U.S. Supreme Court decisions, except under very extreme circumstances. So, big impact.
Next question. Yes, from the center. A little louder, please.
In respect to the question of railroad rights-of-way, I have a follow-up question to Cincinnati, and that is that you said that the government paid eminent domain for the construction of the railroads. My impression was that California was building such a specific railroad that the use of Big Four, of course, of Bowman, Charles Crocker, and Charles Huntington, was to an island.
In my neck of the woods, payments were made to both Indians and non-Indians, ranchers and the like, that to help with the construction of the Burlington Northern. I think that to the key to the lady's question here earlier, though, on rights of way, there have been no rulings made of that sort concerning existing pipelines, for instance, and one of the things that people need to note is that eminent domain usually has the concept of finality. You know, if they take your backyard for part of the federal interstate highway, you get your money, that's it. The highway stays there in perpetuity, and you hopefully invest your money wisely. But, you know, if you have a pipeline and you're a private company and it goes through an Indian reservation, you actually only have it for a term of years. So the statutes don't let you keep that pipeline for longer than, say, 25 years or so. So there's going to come a period of time when you've got to go back to the tribe and say, you know, that pipeline we put back on in there in 1965, well, we renewed it with you. We paid you $1 million a year for every mile. And now it's 1985. We renew it for another 20 years. And inflation and everything, we'll give you three. Now it's 2005, another 20 years has gone by, and you say, well, how about $4 million? And they go, you know, we've been reading all this stuff about the economy and the energy and transportation,
how about $27 million a year? And you go, no. And they say, yes. And they say, no. And you say, what am I supposed to do, build around? And they go, to build around, that would cost you $180. So the new price is $181 or $179. So right now there is, and you say, well, what about the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission? They have the powers of eminent domain. If they want to build a new pipeline from Kansas to California, deliver natural gas to Southern California, well, if you go to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, they say, I don't think we've got eminent domain authority on Indian lands. So your choice right now today, if you want to build new overhead wires or a new natural gas pipeline, is to either pay the troll under the bridge, which has absolutely no link to fair market value, or you build around. Now, try and build a pipeline taking natural gas from sources like the Four Corners area, Texas, Oklahoma, to California, and take a look at a map. You know, how are you going to get through the bottom part of Utah, the left-hand corner of Colorado, or the top of Arizona, without going through the Hopi, the Navajo, the Ute Mountain Utes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? Think about that.
Alex has a response, and then after that, Joe.
Just a quick thing, I mean, that may reconcile the gentleman's view, is that, sure, the Indians were paid. The question is how much. And I think, initially, they were paid literally cent on the dollars. That's obviously no longer true today. But I think from a lot of Indian perspectives, a lot of those railroad right-of-way were basically given away.
But not in California. At the time they were being built, there was mostly just seizure of Indian lands in California. And most of the reservations in California were established by statute or executive order a few decades later.
Joe?
The classic example of you know, dealing with Indian claims to, you know, to get to energy is ANCSA, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. When they discovered oil up in Prudhoe Bay in Alaska in the 60s, they wanted to build a pipeline through, and suddenly they realized, gee, we have all these unresolved, you know, land claims in Alaska, claims to, you know, to ownership. And in 1971, Congress passed an act that just extinguished all land claims. It terminated all the existing reservations. As late as the 70s, the trend was still to terminate reservations and assimilate the tribes, and then set up these state law chartered native corporations. So Congress clearly does have the power to do this. You know, on the issue of land claims, one thing I'd like to point out to people is Congress actually set up a system for dealing with Indian land claims called the Indian Claims Commission. It started in the late 40s and ended up running as late as, I believe, 1978. And the idea was, you know, we're going to deal with all these claims for all time and just settle everything. And, you know, by 1978, you know, we'll just pay off every claim and, you know, we'll finally have peace. And instead, I think the last couple of decades could, you know, fairly be characterized as some of the most intense period of Indian land claims litigation. You know, the legal theories in this area tend to be a little plastic, and you know, this type of momentum tends to feed on itself.
Next question, right here. A little louder so they can hear you in the back.
A lot of the history of the doctrines is presented as the Indian tribes and victims or as part of the trust relationship between the nations. But in modern world, certainly California, Indian tribes are viewed as very powerful, very wealthy players in the political system. Can you comment on the sort of effect of that now on likely solutions to any of these problems? Dan, you started talking about the political contribution issue.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, first of all, I don't know how up-to-date these statistics are, but I do know that within the past 5 years, if you looked at the various groups that made campaign contributions in the state of California, the largest group of campaign contributions came from the California tribes, which was larger than the contributions by the insurance industry, larger than the trial lawyers, larger than the California Teachers Association. I mean, major groups that make major contributions, but the tribal governments in California made greater contributions. And as you may also know, the tribes as sovereigns took the position that they did not have to abide by California's campaign laws and reporting requirements. And the Fair Political Practices Commission sued one of the tribes that was aggressively stating that they had no obligation to comply with California's campaign laws, the Political Reform Act, and that case, Agua Caliente versus Superior Court, ended up first before my old court, the Court of Appeal in Sacramento, and then went to the California Supreme Court, which held that notwithstanding tribal sovereign immunity, notwithstanding the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Kiowa Tribe versus Manufacturing Technologies that I mentioned, that the 10th Amendment and the Guarantee Clause combined precluded the tribe's assertion of sovereign immunity where the state was attempting to enforce its political campaign laws that went to its structure of representative government. And as I understand it, the tribe was talked out of seeking review from the U.S. Supreme Court for fear that this might be the case that the U.S. Supreme Court used to cut back on tribal sovereign immunity. But the results of gaming in the state of California and other states, for those tribes that are able to game, and mind you, I mean, the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act has resulted in a great disparity among those tribes that are in locations where they've got sufficient travel where they can get the patrons to support a gaming operation, and the tribes that are in very remote areas that make it virtually impossible to have a profitable gaming operation. And there are some tribes, some of the larger tribes, that have felt that gaming is simply not something that they want to do and not consistent with their culture. So there is this unevenness. But as to those tribes that are profiting from gaming, I mean, it is a multi-billion dollar industry in California, and those tribes are heard very loudly in Sacramento before the legislature, which makes it harder, I think, to try and provide a rationalized operation in terms of the relationship between the state, local, and tribal governments. Not that, you know, the tribes, you know, shouldn't be entitled like other interest groups to use their funds to lobby, but at least right now in Sacramento, there's a huge impasse because the gaming tribes are so powerful.
Carol, did you have a comment?
Yeah, just a couple of comments about this. One is I think we have to keep the campaign contributions by tribes into some perspective. A lot of these campaign contributions have been related to propositions as well as to individual campaigns. So that the racetracks and the card clubs, as you may all know, have made numerous efforts to introduce initiatives that would give them some standing to carry out gaming in California. And the tribes have been vigilant, as you might expect, in repelling some of these efforts. There were also several initiative measures where the tribes were taking a more active role and trying to get the state of California to agree to gaming. And, of course, it was one of those initiatives that got the state of California to basically repeal the limits on gaming of the type conducted in New Jersey and Nevada for purposes of tribal gaming. That was Proposition 1A. That was 2001, if I'm not mistaken. So a lot of the campaign contributions have to do with these propositions, not just trying to influence particular individual races. Another point I really think is important is that, at least it's my understanding, that at some point in their interactions with the Fair Political Practices Commission, that the Agua Caliente actually offered by agreement to carry out the forms of lobbyist and campaign contribution reporting that the state was demanding as a matter of the imposition of state law. It was not that the tribe was unwilling to provide this information. They didn't feel that the state had the authority to compel them. And this is an example where perhaps greater success in intergovernmental relations, the kind of agreements and compacts that Dan Kolke was talking about, might have produced a good result in the end. And I think I'll stop there.
All right, very good. Last question of the event now, right over here.
This kind of thing is extremely interesting to me, but
interest of talking a little bit on inside baseball stuff, a little bit related to the topic of how the tribal sovereignty interacts with American democratic ideals. So I'd like to ask the panel, what about the issue of people who are not, in fact, allowed to be recognized as Indians? Like, you've heard a lot talk about the immense historical background and genealogical proof that has to be provided before Congress is likely to recognize an Indian tribe or re-recognize an Indian tribe. But the effect of tribal recognition appears to violate the titles of nobility clause in the Constitution. It grants to people who then get their BIFB cards, they host of specific and very broad legal immunities and powers that are available to any other citizens. And I'm not clear on how democratic ideals, and since 1924, all Americans have been American citizens. And certainly, this dragooning of the citizenship has been worse than dragooning all the residents of the Western states after the Treaty of Public Peoples. Although, as American citizens, the Indians have as much claim on the institutions of the United States as all other citizens. But it appears that the reverse is not true. I'm not clear why that should be supported in the future.
Well, thanks very much for getting us back to the theme of our entire panel. Good question. Comments? Responses? Anyone?
You know, if Joe? I would just add one thing. Sorry you can't see me. I actually can't see you either. So I hope you're not someone I know whom I should acknowledge. But, you know, one just illustrative example I used to highlight, and I'm sure Professor Goldberg will have a strong rebuttal on all the horrible things that were done to Indians in the 19th century. But, you know, you actually have counties in the United States or areas in the United States where the state is required under the Voting Rights Act to create a special district for Indians, or sometimes even if the VRA doesn't apply, just Indians have a majority in an area for a state legislative district. That legislative district elects a member who then votes in the state legislature under whether to raise taxes in the state, but guess which part of the state isn't going to be subject to those taxes? Indian country, the states basically have no power to collect taxes in Indian country. It does create some interesting conundrums. And there's actually a county in Montana where the county covers most of an Indian reservation. And tribal members recently organized and got together and won the county supervisor elections, and they now run the county. And again, that county doesn't have jurisdiction over Indians; it only has jurisdiction over the non-Indians. I shouldn't laugh. I mean, this could result in some pretty abusive things. But this does create some real conundrums and challenges in the present day that seem inconsistent with basic rules of fair play and rule of law.
Well, let me just say that Alex made the point earlier that one of the principles of federalism is that local decisions should be made by the people in the locality. And that decision-making should be done at the lowest level of government that's still efficient to make those decisions. And one of the points that I tried to make this morning was that if decision-making should be made by those in the local community who are affected by the decision, we do have this dichotomy in this issue in terms of fitting in with constitutional democratic principles of tribal enterprises that use nearby local community citizens to work there and local community citizens as patrons who have no influence on the laws that govern them when they are working at the enterprise or patronizing the enterprise. And you also have the situation that I alluded to where a tribe can have an enterprise off reservation where it can assert sovereign immunity to avoid being held liable with respect to those commercial activities. So, I think that we have to respect the historic evolution of the role of tribes in this country, but I think that there are some things at the margins that need to be done to improve the application of constitutional democratic principles, particularly for those who are in the local community where the tribal government also sits and those who are affected by the tribal enterprise. And some of those things may have to deal with sovereign immunity issues. I will say that no one really cared about this before the tribes developed you know, significant wealth from enterprises. So I'm certainly aware that, you know, there's a little hypocrisy here in terms of the concern of, you know, principles of constitutional government before the tribes became wealthy, particularly with gaming, and then diversified, and then after. Nonetheless, I think that this may therefore be an opportune time to re-examine some of these things and find a way through negotiation with the tribes and some consensus to bring us back to a more rational relationship.
Anyone else who would like to have the last word from the panel?
I just think a fun fact to know and tell. Just
okay.
To follow up on the influence of money in politics, just some fun facts to know and tell. During the Bush-Cheney administration, there were 42 applications from tribes that wanted the federal government to take land into trust so they could have gaming or something else on that land. 42. Of those 42 applications during the past 8 years, 4 were granted. 4 were denied. Consequently, there are still another 34 out there. 95% of all money donated to the political campaigns for the presidency this past year from Indian tribes went to Obama. 95%. Let's see how many more applications are filed in the next 4 years, and let's see how many of the 34 applications still on the desk for the Office of Indian Gaming are approved.
Well, please join me in thanking the panel for a very instructive and educational event today. Thank you.